Africa, coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Jonathan Jones reporting. The Trump administration is extending temporary protected status for more than 7,000 Syrians living in the United States. TPS allows migrants and refugees to be safe in the U.S. as long as it is too dangerous for them to return home. Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen late on Wednesday said it is clear that conditions upon which Syria's designation was based continue to exist. They include armed conflict and what Homeland Security calls extraordinary and temporary conditions. Civil war, terrorism, and such crimes as crimes against humanity as poison gas attacks led the Obama administration in 2012 to grant TPS to Syrians who had escaped to the United States. President Trump's blueprint for reforming America's immigration system is drawing criticism from both ends of the ideological spectrum. His plan would provide a 10 to 12-year path to citizenship for DACA-eligible immigrants. It would give preference to immigrants with skills needed in the American economy and a visa lottery that gives people across the world a chance to come legally to the United States and would increase border security by erecting a wall between the United States and Mexico. The government has dropped its corruption case against New Jersey Democratic Senator Bob Menendez. Prosecutors decided not to retry him months after his first trial ended with a deadlocked jury. Last week, a judge threw out some of the bribery charges against Menendez, saying prosecutors had failed to prove their case during the first trial. This is VOA News. The head of UNRWA, the UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees, is sharply criticizing severe funding cuts by the United States. He's warning that the action could lead to rising instability in Palestinian territories and the region. Correspondent Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
UNRWA Commissioner General Pierre Kirchenbühl says the agency is facing the worst financial crisis in its history because of a U.S. decision to dramatically reduce its financial contributions.
Last year, the United States provided $360 million to UNRWA. And this year they've announced $60 million. We spend $1.2 to $1.3 billion a year, so that's a significant share of the income that we need.
U.S. President Donald Trump announced the cuts to UNRWA's budget after the U.N. General Assembly overwhelmingly voted to condemn his decision to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. Kirchenbühl tells VOA humanitarian funding should be related to the performance of an organization and not be linked with political considerations. He says the already explosive situation in Gaza will worsen if the funding shortfall remains and Palestinian needs go unmet. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Top Afghan security officials made a surprise visit to Pakistan to discuss mutual cooperation with civilian and military leaders following a series of deadly Taliban and other militant attacks in Afghanistan. Pakistani officials did not release details of the meeting, but the Afghan deputy ambassador in Islamabad said the delegation shared, quote, necessary information with their hosts about recent Taliban-claimed terrorist attacks in Afghanistan. African leaders were very close to officially demanding that President Trump publicly apologize for his reportedly crude remarks about the continent and immigration, but reports say they backed off. The African Union drafted its response to the president at a summit this week. The draft warned that Trump's racist and xenophobic behavior puts the strategic partnership between the United States and Africa at risk. But the AU decided not to release the draft when the president on the January 25th released a letter in which he pledged his deep respect for Africa and announced that Secretary of State Rex Tillerson would make an extended visit to Africa in March. You can find more on these and other late-breaking and developing stories from around the world around the clock at voanews.com and on the VOA News mobile app. I'm Jonathan Jones reporting from the world headquarters of the Voice of America in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, the first day of February. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Zimbabwe names a new elections commission chair, but the opposition is not so impressed.
People of Zimbabwe are demanding fundamental changes to the Electoral Commission and its function, the affirmation of its independence. The appointment of Justice Kibumba does not address those issues.
Simba Makoni is the former Zimbabwe finance minister and leader of the Mavambo Kusili Dawn Party. Kenya's interior minister warns of possible arrest following Odinga's self-inauguration as the people's president. And hospital workers in Togo have begun a two-day strike to demand more personnel and better equipment.
We are fully aware that more needs to be done to continue improving life and work conditions of Togolese population and public workers. But we have to be very responsible and not engage in any commitment that we know cannot be fulfilled.
Gilbert Bawara is Togo's Minister for Public Administration. Uganda's Ministry of Health embarks on a countrywide campaign to fight non-communicable diseases. And the United Nations wants $4 billion to help children in conflict areas. Those stories, plus Samson O'Malley's sports and our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A leading opposition member says what Zimbabweans need today are fundamental changes to the country's electoral commission and its functions, the affirmation of its independence, and the demilitarization of its personnel and operations. Simba Makoni, former finance minister and now the leader of the Mavambo Kusili Dawn Party, says these changes do not bear on any one individual. His comments follow the appointment Wednesday of a new electoral commission chair by President Emmerson Mnangagwa ahead of presidential elections by July this year. She is High Court Judge Priscilla Chigumba and replaces Rita Makarau, who resigned in December last year. Makoni says Justice Chigumba's appointment does not address any of the fundamental changes that Zimbabweans are demanding.
There are two points to make about that. Firstly, what qualifies Judge Chigumba in relation to any other judge in Zimbabwe to chair the Electoral Commission. Secondly, and more importantly, the circumstances behind Justice Rita Makarau's departure from ZEC have not been revealed to the nation. What, therefore, is Judge Chigumba going to correct? What new value is she going to bring that Justice Makarau did not deliver during her tenure? It is not about personalities, it's about institutions and systems and processes. The second and more important point to make is the people of Zimbabwe are demanding fundamental changes to the Electoral Commission and its functioning, the affirmation of its independence, and the demilitarization of its personnel and operations. The appointment of Justice Chigumba does not address any of those issues.
Since the opposition in Zimbabwe had been clamoring for some electoral reforms, one would think that the appointment of Judge Chigumba is a beginning.
Well, it's difficult to say that it's a beginning because changes or reforms that the people are seeking do not bear on individuals, as I said. And so it's difficult to say Justice Chigumba will render ZEC any more independent, any more or less partisan, any more professional than her predecessor merely because of her appointment.
You mentioned the resignation of the former Election Commission Chair, Rita Makarau. Were you saying that there were some reasons that led to her resignation or what?
We all don't know because neither Justice Makarau nor the government of Zimbabwe explained why Justice Makarau left ZEC so abruptly, so unceremoniously to this day. And without that knowledge, it's difficult to judge that the appointment of any other person to replace her represents positive change.
President Mnangagwa has said that there will be elections in Zimbabwe by July this year. What do you, as a member of the opposition, make of that? Is that realistic?
It's not realistic in a number of respects. The first and most important one is merely holding elections for the sake of ticking a box in a calendar does not represent democracy and the will of the people. Because the fundamental changes that would enable Zimbabweans to select a leadership of their choice have not been started. And it is not credible that such a profound process as is required in Zimbabwe can be achieved between now and the end of July or end of August without the government having charted a clear roadmap to fundamental electoral reform.
Suppose the elections are held. The question is, the opposition in Zimbabwe, how prepared would you all be?
We would be prepared to participate in a free and fair election whose legal basis, whose administrative competence has been assured and has been developed in consultation with all key players, including us in opposition politics, to the satisfaction of all. And Mnangagwa is not prepared and is not preparing to submit to such a process.
There was a development on Wednesday where the president has given the white commercial farmers that's a 99-year leases in a bid to resolve the land issue. Any comment?
Yes. Firstly, the affirmation that all Zimbabweans, regardless of color, race, or other attributes, without discrimination, is a positive signal. But the more important issue that Zimbabweans, black, white, who are in agriculture and commercial farming have been seeking is that this instrument called the 99-year lease needs to be tradable and credible at law.
Simba Makoni is former Zimbabwe finance minister and now the leader of the Mavambo Kusili Dawn Party. He was speaking with me from the capital, Harare. Kenya's interior minister warns that arrests in relation to opposition leader Raila Odinga's self-inauguration ceremony on Tuesday as the people's president may be upcoming. Meanwhile, authorities say local media stations that were prevented from broadcasting Tuesday's inauguration live will remain off the air pending the results of an investigation. Mohammed Yusuf reports for VOA from Nairobi.
Interior Minister Fred Matiang'i says Raila Odinga's inauguration was, in his words, a well-choreographed attempt to subvert or overthrow the government.
We have commenced a wide-scale investigation targeting individuals and organizations who include but may not be limited to certain media houses. We will act decisively but strictly according to the law.
On Tuesday, before thousands of supporters gathered at a Nairobi public park, Odinga took a symbolic oath of office as a so-called People's President, an act the government has termed illegal and potentially amounting to treason. Following the Interior Minister's press conference Wednesday, local media were already reporting at least one arrest. A lawyer and opposition MP who stood prominently on stage with Odinga Tuesday, administering the oath. Legal analysts tell VOA it may be difficult for authorities to arrest Odinga, as in the ceremony he did not claim the title of President of the Republic of Kenya. His Twitter account currently identifies him as simply His Excellency. Kenyan lawyer and former chairman of the East Africa Law Society, James Mwamu, says Tuesday's oath by the opposition National Super Alliance, or NASA, carried no legal weight.
Going on forward, however, I think what NASA is intending to do is to rather legitimize this by passing the People's Assembly. So at the end of the day, when the People's Assembly will resolve that this is the way they want to go, then at that particular point, it will obtain some legal meaning. But for now, I think we can safely say in terms of legal interpretation, there is absolutely no effect about the swearing.
NASA is Odinga's opposition coalition. After an October rerun of the August presidential election, Odinga then created the National Resistance Movement, or NRM. Kenyan authorities accused the NRM of planning to incite large-scale violence Tuesday. The Interior Minister cited that accusation as the ground upon which the government cut transmission Tuesday, for four local TV and radio outlets that had planned to broadcast Odinga swearing in live. Odinga boycotted the rerun of the presidential election and has refused to accept President Uhuru Kenyatta's victory, which was certified by the Kenyan Supreme Court. In a sign of the continued political tensions, an identified gunman attacked the home of Deputy Opposition Leader Kalonzo Musyoka with a grenade Tuesday night. Police spokesman Charles Owino says an investigation has been opened.
Fortunately, the hand grenade that exploded is a stun hand grenade. So a stun hand grenade is a grenade that gives you a very loud bang. It is meant to scare. It's not meant to harm or to kill.
More than 3 months after the controversial presidential revote, Kenya's political scene certainly shows no sign of cooling down. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Thursday, the first day of February. Daybreak Africa time is now 16 minutes past the hour. Hospital workers in Togo began a two-day strike yesterday, Wednesday, to protest what they say is a lack of personnel and adequate equipment in hospitals. But the workers say they will continue to provide only emergency services in all public hospitals around the country. Gilba Bawara, Togo's Minister for Public Administration, says President Faure Gnassingbé's government is fully aware that more needs to be done to continue improving the life and working conditions of the Togolese population and public workers. But he said the government must do so responsibly so as not to make commitments that cannot be fulfilled.
During the last 10 years, we have done a lot to improve life and work conditions of the population, especially for the public workers. And we are fully aware that more needs to be done to continue improving life and work conditions of Togolese population and for public workers. But we have to be very responsible and not engage in any commitment that we know cannot be fulfilled. Because public finance has to be managed with responsibility. And we will not want to engage in debt only for public workers. So we have to be very careful. We will continue resorting to dialogue and consultations with trade unions and the representative of workers. But we call to them to refrain from any action that can weaken the administration, that can put the country in further difficult condition and situation.
The hospital workers say they are calling this two-day strike because of what they say is outdated infrastructures in hospitals across Togo and the lack of personnel.
You know, to recruit additional personnel, you need to make sure that you have the financial resources to sustain it in the long term, in the long run. You don't recruit people for one day or 1 week or 1 month, but you recruit them for some period. So this is something we have been doing. We have been recruiting. But to improve health condition, it is not only the issue of the personnel. They rightly say it, we need to continue also modernizing the infrastructure. But this is also something you cannot do overnight. You know, we have been doing it and we will continue to do it. I don't believe this is enough reason to go on strike. So we will continue to discuss and to explain to them the real situation and also the effort and the action that the government has been deploying. So we are very optimistic that it will be possible through dialogue and consultation to stop that type of behavior.
On the issue of the anti-government protest, there was supposed to be dialogue between the government and the coalition of opposition parties. Where are we?
The government has kept with its commitment and willingness to have the dialogue. But as I have been saying to some other people, we don't want to make a confusion between the mean and the objective. Dialogue is a mean to make sure that political actors can make their contribution so that it can be some consensus before we go to political reform. But the main objective is how to make the reform. So the government will continue to be open to dialogue, but the most important objective and issue is how we can make sure that the presidential terms are limited and the modality of electing the president are also modified.
Gilbert Bawara is Togo's Minister for Public Administration. He was speaking with me from the capital, Lome. Uganda's Ministry of Health has embarked on a countrywide campaign to fight non-communicable diseases, or NCDs. Dr. Henry Mwembesa, an official with the Ministry of Health, says NCDs account for at least 40% of total deaths across Uganda.
Dr. Mwembesa, the acting director, General Health Services in the Ministry of Health, says they are holding community meetings, symposia, posters, media campaigns on both print and broadcast to sensitize the population about the dangers of non-communicable diseases.
The risk factors for NCDs remain really very high. And one of the main risk factors is tobacco use, harmful use of alcohol, those of you who drink until morning, physical inactivity, and unhealthy diet. These junk foods we eat every day.
According to the World Health Organization, WHO, non-communicable diseases including cancer, heart diseases, diabetes, chronic respiratory diseases are the leading causes of death in the world. WHO estimates indicate that NCDs account for 70% of death each year for people aged between 30 to 69 years of age. Over 80% of these deaths occur in low and middle-income countries, most of which are in sub-Saharan Africa. Professor Charles Ibingira, the principal of Makerere University of Health Sciences, agrees.
Non-communicable diseases are the biggest danger in this country because malaria deaths have come down. People no longer die of HIV. Instead, they live long actually to suffer from non-communicable diseases, and it is non-communicable diseases that will eventually kill these people.
Dr. Jared Mutunji, who heads the Ministry of Health's Department of Non-Communicable Diseases Control, says a lack of enough resources and people's attitudes are the biggest challenge towards the fight against NCDs.
You know, in some communities, being fat is celebrated. When a bride is about to get married, they force you to take milk so that you expand, you become fat. And even when you get married, when you go to the husband's place, they also force you to take more so that you become... So how do we change that mindset? Because we know obesity is one of the risk factors. Fighting alcohol. Alcohol is a part of our culture. Most of our celebrations include alcohol. How do we tell them that alcohol now is not that good?
He says that simple things like regular screening, eating healthy food, and regular exercise can help one avoid non-communicable diseases. For VOA News, I am Mugume. Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
There are an estimated 2.2 billion children in the world. In a recent report, the United Nations says urgent action is needed to ensure that millions of them have some kind of future to look forward to. VOA's Kevin Enoch reports.
The United Nations estimates that there are 48 million children in the world affected by violence and conflict. But they've just presented the world with a plan for giving them some kind of future.
So UNICEF is launching its appeal. It will be an appeal for $3.6 billion, covering a crisis situation in 51 countries and covering needs that UNICEF intends to meet for 82 million people, including 48 million children.
UN officials say lengthy conflicts in the Middle East and Africa are where children need the most help.
And this goes around the whole world. The crisis that has the highest number is around the Syrian refugees in neighboring countries, and then Syria, Yemen, and many other crises.
Officials say the problem is being made worse by a new trend in warfare to target the institutions that help children stay healthy and get ahead.
Unfortunately, what we see is a bit of a new norm around attacks on schools, on hospitals, on health facilities in general, on water facilities that shouldn't be acceptable. It's just not acceptable to attack children facilities, not acceptable to recruit children, and not acceptable to detain children in those situations. And this is a worrying trend.
The relatively new nation of South Sudan is one of the hardest hit. And officials there say they are trying to save an entire generation of children lost to conflict.
So currently we're doing a demobilization exercise in the south of Sudan in a place called Yambio, where we hope to get at least 580 children out of the military and back to school, back to their communities. Then we'll go to the north of Sudan and hopefully between two sites in the north of Sudan get another 400 out of the military. We're able to reintegrate these children back put them back into school and make them productive members of the society.
UN officials say some of the aid money will go towards getting the estimated 25 million conflict area children who are not in schools back in the classroom. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
Minutes past the hour, time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. Very good Thursday morning to you, Samson.
Good morning to you, James. We begin with the latest update from the 2018 CAF African Nations Championship CHAN, where Sudan, Nigeria, Morocco and Libya were all in action on Wednesday night in the semi-final matches. Host Morocco advanced into the final after defeating Libya 3-1 in extra time. Ayoub El Kaabi got a brace for the Atlas Lions to take his tournament tally to 8 overall. In the second semi-final, the Super Eagles of Nigeria defeated Sudan 1-0 despite an early injury to their first-choice goalkeeper and captain, Ikechukwu Ezenwa, and a red card to Ifeanyi Ifeanyi to set up an exciting final with host Morocco on Sunday. Shortly after the match, I spoke with some football fans back here in Abuja who surprisingly have favoured Morocco to lift the trophy.
The Moroccans are a better side than Nigeria. We only struggle to get through the group stages. You know, they play more delightful brand of football. They play more robust goal. They are, by and large, a better side than Nigeria.
It's going to be very difficult for the Super Eagles of Nigeria. Number one, Morocco is playing at home, and they will have all the support from their fans at home.
Well, Monagably, they've been the best of teams so far in the competition, and you just get the feeling that they both deserve it. Even though the Moroccans have been able to sweep aside most of the teams with so much ease, it's been a bit topsy-turvy for the Nigerians. They've been able to grow into the tournament. Their first game, they drew against the Rwandans before they won their final two matches.
Staying with football news, 2015 CAF African Footballer of the Year and Gabon's Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang joined English Premiership side Arsenal for £56 million for a deadline day record transfer deal for Arsenal. The Gabon striker, who scored 141 goals in 213 games for Dortmund, including 21 in 24 matches this season, in his first interview said he was delighted to join a great team like Arsenal.
I'm really happy to be here in this great team. I think the club have such a big history, and they are the great players like Thierry Henry, so it's an example for our strikers.
Elsewhere in cricket news, the South African national cricket team, the Proteas, will be looking to strike the balance between results and a look to the future when they take on India in the first Momentum One-Day International ODI at Sahara Stadium, Kingsmead, on Thursday. Proteas captain Fav du Plessis says,
"It's important the last 2 days we wanted to step up the intensity a little bit, make sure we get through quite intense fielding. As you know, one day cricket is very important to your fielding is up to standard. So, yeah, two hard practices ready for the game tomorrow."
And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. We look forward to your report again tomorrow. And that is it for this Thursday, February 1st edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Shrayak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Jimmy Cook, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Interested in deeper analysis of news and events in Africa? Then plan to join me, Douglas Impuga, on Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll have African journalists and expert guests discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. So plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, political tensions simmer in Kenya as opposition leader Raila Odinga takes a symbolic presidential oath of office as the people's president, despite warnings from the nation's attorney general, who called the mock swearing-in of Odinga an act of treason. An in-depth look at Kenya's political future on the next Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.